Introduction to the Talking Book Program. On behalf of the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped of the Library of Congress, welcome to the Talking Book Program. I'm Gordon Gould, and as your host, I'll give you a short introduction and a brief sampling of our recorded books.
La introducción en español al programa de libros parlantes es grabado en el lado 4.
But first, what are talking books and talking magazines? How do you find out what can be borrowed? How do you choose? How do you get them? And whom do you write or call if you have questions or when your equipment needs repair? Talking books are recordings of the same kind of reading material found in any public library. We have classics. We have current bestsellers. There's fiction and nonfiction, science fiction, humor, science, history, religion, sports, politics, and the arts. You can also select from how-to and children's books, westerns, mysteries, plays, and poetry, and from a variety of magazines. Readers like you tell us what kinds of books and other reading material to record or to produce in Braille. Advisory committees made up of readers and librarians also help decide which new books and magazines to add to the program. Most of our recorded magazines are produced on flexible discs. Most older books are recorded on hard, phonograph-like records. But increasingly, you'll find the greatest choice of books on cassettes. Some recordings are made at the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped in Washington, D.C. Most are recorded under contract with the American Foundation for the Blind in New York or the American Printing House for the Blind in Louisville, Kentucky. And some titles are recorded by volunteer narrators. Once recorded and produced in many copies, the books are sent to more than 160 regional and sub-regional libraries throughout the nation, where they are ready for you to borrow. Magazines are sent directly to you by the producers. You'll be hearing a lot about your regional or sub-regional library. The one serving your area will help keep service personal and quick. How do you know exactly what books can be borrowed? As new books are recorded and ready for circulation, short descriptions are published in Talking Book Topics. This magazine is recorded on flexible disc and is printed in large type. It's published by the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped and mailed to you every other month. And it's free to keep. Your name has already been added to the Talking Book Topics mailing list, and you'll receive it for as long as you're in the program. You may want to ask your librarian whether back issues are available. From time to time, you'll also have access to catalogs and special subject bibliographies listing reading material you can borrow. In all these sources, books are identified by format and number. You'll soon recognize that books with an RD number are books recorded on discs. Similarly, RC is short for recorded cassette. Order forms come with talking book topics, catalogs, and bibliographies. Just check the books you want to borrow and mail the form to your local or regional librarian. No postage is required in connection with this or any other part of the Library of Congress reading program. Your assigned library is ready to help beyond filling book orders. No matter where you go in the States or overseas, you'll always be able to receive books and magazines. If you're moving, either permanently or temporarily, give advance notice to your librarian in writing so that your service is uninterrupted. Now, what about equipment? Excessive record wear is often caused by worn phonograph needles. Background noise and garbled voices are indication that the needle cartridge should be turned over or changed. As a bit of preventive maintenance, the needle should be cleaned occasionally with a soft brush or cloth. Cassette machines also need to be dusted from time to time. Just brush softly around the tape head and cassette well area, and be sure that the cassette tape is taut before putting the cartridge in the machine. If you think something is amiss with your equipment, if there are extraneous noises or speed changes, it's best to contact your librarian to find out what to do or where to send the equipment for repair. Since 1934, the Library of Congress reading program has grown to include thousands of individuals with temporary or permanent physical as well as visual disabilities. Besides recorded books and magazines, the library also offers a wide choice of books and magazines in Braille, and an extensive music service is available directly from the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Braille and large print music books and scores, instructional recordings, and magazines are offered for every taste and interest. Recorded materials are instructional in nature, as opposed to symphonies, rock, and other music for listening pleasure. Ask your librarian about our music services, or write directly to the music section, National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, Washington, D.C., 20542. The books themselves, however, are the best introduction to the Talking Book program. Take Roots. Alex Haley's bestseller about a man's search for his identity is read by actor Earl Hyman, a Talking Book narrator for the American Foundation for the Blind.
Near the fence row that flanked the main road, Irene was busily picking leaves to press into dry perfumes when she looked up, hearing the sound of a galloping horse's hoofs. She gasped, seeing the horseman wearing a flowing green scarf and a black derby with a curving rooster tail feather jutting up from the hatband. Waving her arms wildly, she raced toward the road, crying out of the top of her lungs, "Chicken George! Chicken George!" The rider reined up just beyond the fence, his lathered horse heaving with relief. "Do I know you, gal?" he called, returning her smile. "No, sir, we ain't never seen one another. But Tom, Mammy, Tilda, and the family talk about you so much, I knows what you look like." He stared at her. "My Tom and Tilda?" "Yes, sir. Your wife and my husband. My baby's daddy." It took him a few minutes to register it. "You and Tom got a child?" She nodded, beaming and patting her protruding stomach. "It do another month." He shook his head. "Lord God. Lord God Almighty. What's your name?" "Irene, sir." Telling him to ride on, she hurried clumsily as fast as she dared until she reached within vocal range of where Virgil, Ashford, Little George, James, Lewis, Little Kizzy, and Lily Sue were planting in another section of the plantation. Her loud hallooing quickly brought a worried Little Kizzy, who raced back to relay the incredible news. They all breathlessly reached the slave row, shouting and surging about their father, mother, and Tom, and all trying at once to embrace him until a pummeled and disarrayed Chicken George was entirely overwhelmed with his reception. "Guess best y'all hears the bad news first," he told them, "and then of the deaths of Grandmammy Kizzy and Sister Sarah. Old Mrs. Lee, she gone too." When the griefs of their losses had abated somewhat, he described Miss Meliza's condition, and then his experience with Massa Lee, finally resulting in the freedom paper that he triumphantly displayed.
Or, for a textbook approach, try John Kenneth Galbraith's book, Money, Whence It Came, Where It Went, narrated by Alan Hewitt. An actor and television personality, Hewitt also records for the American Foundation for the Blind.
In the United States, the post-war boom continued through 1919 and well into 1920. Then came severe depression. The Federal Reserve System, its role as the guardian against boom and bust in abeyance, at a minimum facilitated both. While prices were rising and speculation in commodities and land was proceeding, it kept interest rates low. The commercial banks borrowed freely from the Federal Reserve banks to meet the speculative as well as the other needs of their clients. The U.S. Treasury, which still had to sell bonds, supported the soft policy, although much must also be attributed to the fear of cautious men that they would prick the bubble. Then they would be blamed personally for the collapse. Better let it come by itself. Soon it did. Early in 1920, with military needs at an end, wartime scarcity overcome, and overseas orders no longer being sustained by American loans, prices leveled off and began to fall. Once the turn came, the Federal Reserve recovered its courage. The rediscount rate was raised to an unprecedented 6%. Loans by the Reserve banks, two banks which had been increasing, tapered off and then fell sharply. In 1921, they were less than half the 1920 level. From mid-1920 on, the United States suffered what many believe to have been the sharpest depression to that time in its history. The Federal Reserve, facing its first major test, could not be said to have passed with flying or any other colors. By common agreement, it assisted the boom and worsened the bust. This has always been considered an especially interesting era.
Alexander Scorby has been an American Foundation for the Blind talking book narrator since 1937. He's recorded more than 300 books, including the difficult Ulysses by James Joyce, War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, and Humboldt's Gift by Saul Bellow. Here, he reads from The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Daisy took the brush with delight and smoothed her hair, whereupon Gatsby sat down and shaded his eyes and began to laugh.
"It's the funniest thing, old sport," he said hilariously. "I can't when I try to..."
He had passed visibly through two states and was entering upon a third. After his embarrassment and his unreasoning joy, he was consumed with wonder at her presence. He had been full of the idea so long, dreamed it right through to the end, waited with his teeth set, so to speak, at an inconceivable pitch of intensity. Now, in the reaction, he was running down like an overwound clock. Recovering himself in a minute, he opened for us two hulking patent cabinets which held his masked suits and dressing gowns and ties, and his shirts piled like bricks in stacks a dozen high. "I've got a man in England who buys me clothes. He sends over a selection of things at the beginning of each season, spring and fall." He took out a pile of shirts and began throwing them one by one before us. Shirts of sheer linen and thick silk and fine flannel, which lost their folds as they fell and covered the table in many-colored disarray. While we admired, he brought more, and the soft, rich heap mounted higher, shirts with stripes and scrolls and plaids in coral and apple green and lavender and faint orange with monograms of Indian blue. Suddenly, with a strained sound, Daisy bent her head into the shirts and began to cry stormily.
"They're such beautiful shirts,"
she sobbed, her voice muffled in the thick folds.
"It makes me sad because I've never seen such beautiful shirts before."
Terry Hayes Sales is an active narrator for the American Printing House for the Blind. This passage is from Barbara Willard's novel, The Lark and the Laurel.
Dame Elizabeth sent Nicholas Forge riding to Gill's Hatch to ask the Orlebars for their company at noon on Christmas Day, and from there he was to go in search of Sir James. Although Cecily was sure in her heart that they must come, she waited on pins till her aunt's secretary returned with the answer. "Sir James was already at Gill's Hatch," he told Dame Elizabeth, "so my journey was halved. And all thank you for your courtesy, and we'll be glad to come to Mantlemas on Christmas Day." "There now, Cecily," said her aunt, "you and I must set about ordering the feast." While she waited for Nicholas Forge to return from Gill's Hatch, Cecily had been adding to the pile of lavender bags, at which she stitched for some time every day. Dame Elizabeth had said she needed 100. She counted them, and there were 50. Her fingers were sore with stitching. Her hands by now were greatly changed. What had been so white and tender had hardened and darkened. What would Alice say if she could see them? And what in heaven's name would her father think of the coming feast, the freedom and the assorted company with whom she would happily sit down? Since the moment when she had seemed to see her own future, when the lark and the laurel swam out of dream into reality, Cecily had banished all thought of her father. Now she experienced a sharp spasm of fear, and if Lewis had been there, she would have cried out to him for help, as she had done as they walked together by the shore. Her father was her father still. Unless he died, she was bound to see him again. Where was he? And was Alice with him? And what plans were they making far away in France?
there is a variety of books on religion in the Talking Book program. In this segment, Arnold Moss reads from The Five Great Religions, produced by the American Foundation for the Blind.
I am not telling the Christian to become a Hindu or a Buddhist or the Jew or the Muslim to become a Christian. What I have tried to do is to present Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, and Islam, each in its own terms, and to reflect Christianity against them. I have tended to stress the mystical aspects and traditions of all the religions. They are basic in Hinduism and Buddhism and need no extra emphasis. Because while mystics may quantitatively be a minority, they form the inner soul of all religions. If we are not looking for quality in a religion, then religion exists more as a sociological and cultural force than as a valid means of establishing a relationship between man and the divine. In both Hinduism and Buddhism, mysticism in some form or other is the goal of ordinary life, though naturally man, being weak, often fails in the search. Though not all men can follow the path, the search for the interior life is considered normal and acceptable. In the monotheistic religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, mysticism, it must be admitted, is not the conventional way except for a certain few. In these faiths, the mystic has often been suspect and sometimes has even been persecuted. In death, the mystic usually achieves a certain respectability and may even be sainted. But the live mystic is always a threat. His quiet devotion, piety, asceticism, gentleness, his otherworldliness and eschewing of such necessities as shelter, food, clothing, and money, his disregard for social position, rank, and caste are compelling arguments for his beliefs and are dangers to orthodoxy, particularly when the institutions must follow a different path.
Then there's Frank Herbert's science fiction novel, Dune. It's narrated by John Berrill, a volunteer reader for the Cleveland Society for the Blind.
Jessica thrust the leaf aside, whirled to dash back to Paul. In that instant, the airlock door slammed open. Paul jumped through it, holding something in his right hand, slammed the door behind him. He saw his mother, pushed through the leaves to her, glanced at the fountain, thrust his hand and the thing it clutched under the falling water. Paul! She grabbed his shoulder, staring at the hand. What's that? He spoke casually, but she caught the effort behind the tone. Hunter seeker. Caught it in my room and smashed its nose, but I want to be sure. Water should short it out. Immerse it, she commanded. He obeyed. Presently, she said, withdraw your hand. Leave the thing in the water. He brought out his hand, shook water from it, staring at the quiescent metal in the fountain. Jessica broke off a plant stem, prodded the deadly sliver. It was dead. She dropped the stem into the water, looked at Paul. His eyes studied the room with a searching intensity that she recognized, the BG way. This place could conceal anything, he said. I've reason to believe it's safe, she said. My room was supposed to be safe, too. Hawat said, it was a hunter-seeker, she reminded him. That means someone inside the house to operate it. Seeker control beams have a limited range. The thing could have been spirited in here after Hawat's investigation. But she thought of the message of the leaf. Defection of a trusted companion or lieutenant. Not Hawat, surely. Oh, surely not Hawat. Hawat's men are searching the house right now, he said. That seeker almost got the old woman who came to wake me. The shout-out Mapes, Jessica said, remembering the encounter at the stairs. A summons from your father to... That can wait, Paul said. Why do you think this room's safe?
Jack Hurkacz has narrated since 1974. He's read The Final Days by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, and Robert Persig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Here he reads from Art Buchwald's I am not a crook.
A group of us were sitting around the dining room table the other night when suddenly someone asked, "What did people talk about in this country before Watergate?" There was shocked silence. It was hard for any of us to believe there was anything before Watergate. "Didn't we talk about meat?" one of the men asked. "I think we did," one of the ladies replied, "but I can't remember what we said about it." "I believe it had to do with the price of it. Wasn't there something about a boycott?" someone added. "That's correct," a man said. "We kept saying the price of steak was too high. But surely we talked about other things besides meat." We all started racking our brains. "Wait a minute," a friend shouted. "Wasn't there something about amnesty?" "You mean for people involved in Watergate?" "No, stupid. We talked about amnesty before Watergate. It had to do with draft dodgers." "It's funny," a woman said. "I always get amnesty and immunity mixed up."
"So does the president. If it hadn't been for Watergate, Nixon planned to make a big issue of amnesty."
"I don't recall talking much about amnesty," another person said. "In our family, we talked about how McGovern blew the election."
"Who's McGovern?" someone asked.
"He was the Democratic candidate who ran against Nixon in the election."
"What election?"
"The presidential election of 1972. If it hadn't been for the election, we wouldn't have had a Watergate." "Now it's coming back to me. McGovern ran with an Indian named Eagle Feather," a lady said.
"Eagle Ton," her husband corrected her. "And he wasn't an Indian. He was treated for shock." "He was not treated for shock. He was treated with shock. That's why What's-His-Name dropped him from the ticket."
"Well, then who ran with McGovern?"
Nobody at the table could remember.
The last selection is from 1876, a novel by Gore Vidal. The many voices of Roy Avers, an American printing house for the blind narrator, bring the characters of this book to life.
Opening the Herald, Bryant found me on page 3. With an amused inflection, he read aloud the reporter's account of the arrival in New York of the celebrated author Charles Schermerhorn Schuyler and his daughter, the Princess Day Regent.
"A Turkish title from the sound of it."
"No, Bosnian." Bryant's humor still lurks behind that awesome face he sees fit to petrify the world with. As practicing journalists, we enjoyed the confident incoherence of the interviewer and deplored the low standards of today's journalism.
"And yet,"
the maid interrupted us, not with coffee or tea as I had prayed, but with Bryant's top coat and beaver hat,
"the newspaper press can take a great deal of credit for having destroyed Mr. Tweed in 73.
I noticed sourly that the maid did not even attempt to help me on with my top coat, and due to a rheumatic shoulder, I have more difficulty than does Bryant getting in and out of clothes.
With some aid from Governor Tilden. Of course, a capital fellow. Do you know him?"
"Yes, slightly." We were now in the street. School-bound children carried their books in that never-out-of-date shoulder sling, whilst a ragged man pulled a sort of barrow after him on which he had placed a large tin bucket of boiling water, fired from beneath by a kerosene burner. The man's hoarse cry still sounds in my head.
"Here's your nice hot corn, smoking hot, smoking hot, just from the pot."
I used to collect such songs of the street. "What sort of corn does he find in December?" I asked as we turned into Fifth Avenue.
"From Florida. The railroads, Schuyler, the railroads. They have changed everything, for the good, for the bad."
He took my arm. "Do come and see our new quarters. We moved last summer to the corner of Fulton and the Broadway.
A 10-story building. Terrible expense, frankly, but convenient. Also, the presses are hidden away at the bottom. And we even have a perpendicular railway, which I refuse to set foot in. One must always walk, walk, climb, walk, climb."
What you've just heard is a sampling from the Library of Congress collection. Narrators are matched to books as closely as possible. And the more varied your reading, the more narrators you'll hear. As time goes on, if you have comments about books and narrators, write us and tell us what you think. Once again, don't hesitate to write to your librarian about equipment and to order books and magazines. Your questions and comments will reach the right people for response. In closing, I'd like to wish you many hours of reading enjoyment.